Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today we talk with two authors. Carrie Ann Noble of Lycoming County talks about her debut novel, The Mermaid Sister, which won Amazon's Breakthrough Novel of the Year contest in 2014 in the young adult category. But first, Peter Lawrence discusses his book, Becoming Jane Jacobs. Jacobs is the pioneering urban thinker responsible for many aspects of modern cities. Here's WPSU's Eleanor Klibanoff.
For those who aren't familiar with her work, who was Jane Jacobs?
Jane Jacobs is commonly remembered as an activist in Greenwich Village, and particularly for her efforts in helping to stop the Lower Manhattan Expressway. But equally, as the author of The Death and Life of Great American Cities, that's, of course, a very well-known and widely read book.
Tell us a little more about that book.
Death and Life of Great American Cities is considered by many one of the most important books written on cities for a couple of generations since it was published in 1961, been widely read by many people in a variety of fields, including architects and city planners, sociologists, geographers, economic geographers, and so on. It's a canonical text. It's very much represents a paradigm shift in the way people understand cities, and I think that status is warranted.
Jacobs is an activist and an author, but your book looks beyond that story to what you call the unknown Jane Jacobs. What did you find?
Well, what I've tried to do with Becoming Jane Jacobs is talk about what I sometimes describe as the first half of her career. So Death and Life was published when she was 45. And so, you know, she had a good decade and a half as a professional writer before then. It's not quite the half. There's more of a career that that follows and a good many books that follow Death and Life. But establishing really where Death and Life came from, and therefore also the foundation for those other books, is part of what I've tried to bring forward. And very little was known about those previous years. So that's what I've really emphasized in terms of the narrative or biography of her life, but with a feeling that that establishes what follows.
Part of the story that you uncover is about her work as a critic at Architectural Forum, where Jacobs first encountered many of these urban ideas. How did that time inform her thinking?
On one hand, she's known as someone who didn't even have a college degree. And there's this idea that she was kind of savant, a genius. But what I've tried to show in really looking at those years at Architectural Forum, which begin in 1952 and continue until she takes a leave from the magazine to start this book project in 1958, those years are really incredibly important in her education as an urbanist. And in those short number of years, she learns a lot, and even her ideas are evolving and changing. But these critical years had really been not examined in previous biographies, and not something that she really spoke much about, except to say that she had worked there.
A lot was happening in cities in the late 40s and 50s when Jacobs was writing.
Absolutely. It's a critical time in American history for the American environment. After World War II, well, there's a housing shortage, for one thing. There's a rather depleted housing supply. Throughout the war years, there was really no domestic construction. All materials were rationed for the war effort. In the post-war period, the U.S. Housing Act of 1949, that has to do with developing the suburbs and redeveloping cities in an effort to provide new housing stock, has relatively little impact on urban redevelopment as compared to the revised act, the U.S. Housing Act of 1954. And with that one, we have urban renewal proper. And also what happens in that year is a U.S. Supreme Court decision Berman versus Parker, which basically upholds the underlying principles of urban renewal, specifically that so long as there's a good plan that is seen to be to the greater good, that private property, even if it's not terribly deteriorated, could be taken by eminent domain. And it's with that legislation and that judicial decision that we see urban renewal really take off.
Jacobs is pretty critical of these urban renewal projects. Where did that come from?
So in the early 50s, this might come as a surprise to some, she actually idealizes the field of city planning and really believes in the efforts to modernize U.S. cities or improve U.S. cities through the urban redevelopment legislation. So her ideas evolve throughout the 50s from one of a kind of idealization to quite the opposite. And I think part of the vehemence and passion we see in Death and Life, particularly in the first chapter, where she's really attacking city planning theory and theorists, is in part continued or sort of latent anger even at herself for having believed some of these ideas. By the time she's involved in writing Death and Life in the late 50s, as she's explaining the project to some confidants, she says that the theories out there are really no help at all. Really, one has to begin from the ground up.
Jacobs ran up against Robert Moses a few times in her career. Moses was sort of the chief architect of New York City at the time. What was that relationship like?
Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses are these kind of David and Goliath figures. When she moves to New York, he's already much involved in New Deal era infrastructure projects and building projects and actually many things that he's admired for. With the urban redevelopment legislation of the post-war period, legislation which lends itself to some abuse and perhaps even some corruption, things change, and we see a kind of much more aggressive efforts to transform cities. And so it's really the post-war Robert Moses that becomes something of a villain. Jacobs encounters him really for the first time as an activist in the late 1950s when she gets involved in an ongoing community effort to save Washington Square Park in New York from being bisected by an extension of Fifth Avenue.
So while Moses was working on these large-scale urban renewal projects, Jacobs argued for more of a community approach. Did she think that residents would just improve the city themselves?
That was very much the question that was on the table in some of her activism and in Death and Life at large. If planning theory and practices are failures, is all top-down planning a failure? When she was involved in her second major activist project, which was a campaign known as Save the West Village, her own neighborhood, including her own home, from being designated an urban renewal district or area that was would be subject to eminent domain clearance and basic bulldozing. What was on the table in that fight was city planning at large, and the New York City Planning Commission, basically fought back against the community campaign, community activism, in rather philosophical terms, saying that to some extent the city planners knew better, and that they were not going to listen to a bunch of amateurs, even if they lived there. But moreover, that planning commissioners saw this activism as a kind of advocacy for the status quo, for a laissez-faire approach to cities and their development or redevelopment, And the City Planning Commission said, we don't believe in that position.
Right, and those are the ideas that Jacobs was putting forward in Death and Life of Great American Cities. How was her book received at the time?
Death and Life was pretty quickly understood to be an instant classic, as some people called it. There was a sense, and Jacobs knew this as well, that it was well-timed, that this was the right moment for this book and for the ideas in it to be expressed. Though at the same time, there were many commentators would say things like, she gets some things really right and she gets some things really wrong. It really depends on something of perhaps their own ideologies and their own aspirations and beliefs for a better society and better cities. For example, some argued that her ideas were something about a preservation of the status quo, in the sense that her attack on certain planning practices were interpreted as an attack on all city planning practices. One of the things I've tried to sort out in Becoming Jane Jacobs is the ways in which she didn't necessarily attack any planning principles or ideas in Death and Life. But in fact, there were some that she very affirmatively advocated.
What do you think Jacobs would make of cities today, particularly the debate around gentrification?
There's always gentrification at some level. Jacobs understands that and alludes to the fact that in Death and Life of Great American Cities, that her own neighborhood, Greenwich Village, had gone through periods of gentrification and decline and regentrification, so that she understands the dynamics of that kind. She also understands within that history and within those historical dynamics, forces like racism and various forms of discrimination that push out the poor or minorities. That's taking place in some ways throughout a couple hundred years of New York's history. By the late 50s, and when she's writing Death and Life, it's the beginning of the decline in population, largely because of suburban growth. When we talk about gentrification today, we're talking about cities in a time of revival.
So now that cities are beginning to see a resurgence, are Jacobs' ideas still relevant?
I think that people still read Death and Life today because it is really still very fresh. I think the book's had a very long shelf life. You know, many of the ideas have a kind of, well, maybe to exaggerate the point, a kind of like a natural law, like a law of nature practically. You know, so for example, Jacobs, you know, said of the four critical components of urban diversity were mixed primary uses, short blocks, the need for aged buildings or old buildings, and the need for concentration or density. You know, those are just some of the ideas that don't seem like they're going to be overturned or explained away.
In the end, Jacobs left New York for Toronto, saying, quote, "I fought as long as I could, but I've had enough. There's no virtue in fighting battles and losing." What do you make of that?
I think that Jacobs, you know, had periods of real doubt about the impact of her ideas. She also lived through a pretty difficult time in the sense of, you know, a career that's really developing during the World War II and the Cold War, and then in the 50s being caught up with the problems of urban renewal and then fighting them, then finding her own community under attack in the Washington Square battle, then her own home and neighborhood under attack, and literally within weeks of her finishing the manuscript for Death and Life, she finds herself having to defend her own neighborhood in ways she had just explained somewhat more abstractly, somewhat more theoretically in Death and Life. And then she's involved helping to prevent the Lower Manhattan Expressway. And then she's into the Vietnam War era, which she doesn't believe in. And she's concerned about her sons in the draft. It's a pretty has a pretty busy and I think draining couple of decades. And then there's the fact that she was not a professional activist. Her desire was to be a writer. And each one of these activist battles, which she felt compelled to be engaged in, was at the same time taking away time from writing. By the end of the 60s, she has had enough. But the Vietnam War is very much a precipitating factor for her move to Toronto. But, of course, when she gets there, she gets involved in other battles and helps to stop the Speedy Expressway in Toronto. So, yeah, she continues as an activist while her primary efforts are as a writer and an author.
Well, she wouldn't be Jane Jacobs if she wasn't getting involved.
That's right. That's right. These are two activities that grow together throughout her life, and it's difficult to separate them.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thanks for your interest.
That was Eleanor Klibanoff talking with Peter Lawrence about his new book, Becoming Jane Jacobs. Lawrence teaches architectural and urban design at Clemson University School of Architecture. Next, WPSU's Christine Allen talks with Carrie Ann Noble, who writes novels and short stories mostly for a young adult audience. Her debut novel, The Mermaid Sister, won first place in the young adult category of Amazon's Breakthrough Novel of the Year contest in 2014. It was published in 2015.
Carrie Ann Noble, thank you so much for joining us on Take Note.
It's my pleasure.
Were you an avid reader growing up?
Oh, absolutely. My mom started taking me to the library before I could walk, I think.
What kinds of books did you like?
I read everything from Winnie the Pooh to anatomy books when I was young.
Any particular favorites?
When I became a teenager, I became obsessed with the Gormenghast trilogy by Mervyn Peake. I also read everything imaginable in the science fiction category.
You went to Penn State. What did you study?
I did. I studied theater arts.
Acting or costuming or something else?
I thought I wanted to be an actor, but I was really a big chicken. And so I kind of stayed in the background and did a lot of costume department things and some backstage work.
At what point did you decide, or did you ever decide, that you wanted to be a writer, a novelist?
I always loved writing and making things up. I remember making up stories and plays with my sister when I was very, very small. And then I wrote funny stories with my best friend about our stuffed rabbits when we were young. And we moved on from there to writing kind of a soap opera in a comic strip format.
Really?
And
did you draw the pictures too?
Yes, we did. And we mailed them back and forth to each other all summer. So that was exciting.
The Mermaid Sister, your new novel, or fairly new, came out last year, is a fanciful young adult story, which I enjoyed reading very much. But tell us in your own words what the book is about.
The book is about a 16-year-old girl named Clara who lives in the mountains of Pennsylvania with her sister, and they're adopted. They came to live on the mountain with an old woman they call Auntie, and they were dropped off there in mysterious ways and ended up being a family together. And one day, Clara discovers that her sister Marin is becoming a mermaid, and she knows she has to get her to the sea before she dies. And so she and their best friend O'Neill go on an adventure in a gypsy wagon, and they have to get to the ocean, and they face some real obstacles along the way, including a nefarious traveling carnival.
There is a definite historical period in your book, which all those gypsy wagon, you know, details bring to life very strongly. The year 1870 in the mountains of Pennsylvania. Why did you choose that place and time?
Well, I enjoyed that time period very much. I watched Little House on the Prairie a lot growing up, and I wanted it to be after the Civil War so I didn't have to deal with any of that going on. Mm-hmm. And I was just very familiar with that time period from other things I'd read. And I've always enjoyed that time period and been drawn to it.
And during that time, there was a lot of folk magic being practiced in the mountains of Pennsylvania, which sort of works into your story. It's a story with a lot of fantasy elements. Tell me how you decided on the world for your characters.
It really just kind of happened. I decided to have a girl turning into a mermaid, and then her pet dragon kind of just came along to me, and I just enjoyed mixing the real life with the fantasy life.
And the pet dragon, Osbert, is adorable. He acts like every adorable animal, but he's a dragon. It's crazy. I know that your late sister, your sister Kate, was the inspiration for Marin, the girl who's turning into a mermaid. Tell us about your sister, to whom you dedicated the novel. What was she like?
Well, my sister was really not much like Marin. She was a bright and generous person, but she wasn't like Marin, so flighty and kind of self-centered. My sister, she just brought light to everyone, and she was a beautiful person, and I'm glad to remember her in this way. And I think it honors her. And I also feel the book was a gift from her, because I wouldn't have written this story if I hadn't gone through this with her.
And it's a way to process all of that grief in it, into channel it into something positive as well.
Yes.
You know, I knew this before I read the book, and so I noticed throughout some of the details about her turning into a mermaid seem to be strongly parallel with someone who's going through a terminal illness, the pale, scaly skin, the tendency to sleep a lot. She talks less and less. She communicates less. Her voice gets softer as she becomes a mermaid and even stops eating. It sounds to me like those would all have been things you went through with Kate.
Yes, they were. A lot of those things came from life. And there are moments in there that were true moments I had with my sister. And I see them. My grandmother recognizes them when she reads it. But ultimately, I feel it's a happy ending. I believe my sister had a happy ending, and she's in a better place now. So I was glad to give that to her and to myself. It comforted me to write it out like that.
What about the heroine, Clara? How much of you is there in Clara?
I don't know. I definitely some of me, but there are things she did that I would not have done. However, I recognize her journey in finding out that you're stronger than you think. I learned that myself in this journey with my sister.
Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of love triangle in the story with a young man named O'Neill, which made me wonder, is there an O'Neill? Is he based on someone you knew?
No, he really just came out of my head. His name came from my friend's neighbor's dog. I was staying with her when I was developing the story in my head, and I heard someone call the neighbor's dog O'Neill, and I thought, well, that's a good name. I'll use that.
I thought that was interesting for the first name of a character, the given name. You chose a place, an actual place that exists as your setting, Lanfear Mountain, which I believe is in Cambria County, Pennsylvania, right?
Well, I hadn't heard of that.
I
looked it up, and I guess there was a mining town by that name.
There's a town on a mountain called Lanfear, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's actually, I don't know if the mountain is called that, but it is someplace on a mountain. So this wasn't intended to be a particular real place in Pennsylvania, just in
No, just in the mountains of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Which is where I spent a lot of my time growing up and where I live now.
Okay. You said you knew a lot about the 19th century, that era in history in Pennsylvania. I was wondering about all the detail in the traveling performers and what they do. Is that something you were familiar with at the time, or did you have to research that, or...?
I researched that quite a bit. I had kind of, since I started writing novels, intended to write a novel about a traveling medicine show. And so then it just fit into this story.
You wrote this book during National Novel Writing Month in 2012. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
Did you write the whole thing in a month?
Most of it I did. I did have to go back and change some things, but a lot of it I wrote that month.
Tell us what National Novel Writing Month is and why you do it.
It is a yearly event where people sign up online to write an entire novel of 50,000 words or more in 30 days. And it's really fun because you're cheering each other on and you have charts and graphics to show your progress. And it's just a way for people to get things done. And you have to write so quickly that you don't have time to self-edit. You don't have time to stop and look back. You just plow forward and get it done, which is wonderful for procrastinators like me.
Where does one begin to write a novel? Where do you start? Page one or with ideas that you jot down? Or
I usually just have a general idea of a beginning and an end and some characters and just go from there. I don't tend to outline very much, and I'm trying to change that because I think it would be beneficial and might make me write quicker and more efficiently. But usually I just go where the story takes me.
Do you write in order, or do you just write a scene here and a scene there and skip around in the book?
I tend to write in order.
The Mermaid Sister won Amazon's Breakthrough Novel Award in the category of Young Adult Fiction in 2014. How did you decide to enter the Amazon contest?
There had been advertising for it on the NaNoWriMo website. And I, for some reason, I just decided to go for it and I sent it in. I had no idea that it would get past all the stages of judging that it had to go through. I really wanted to get to the stage of judging where they gave you a free Publisher's Weekly review of your book, because then I could know what I needed to fix. But then it just kept going until the end.
How did you find out? Tell me about the moment when they told you.
I got to the finals. And at that point, I kind of forgot what day they were going to announce who won. And I wasn't paying much attention because I guess I didn't really expect to win. And the phone rang and I saw on the caller ID, it said Amazon. And I thought, oh, they're calling to ask me about my recent purchases. I just had no idea that it would be them calling to congratulate me on winning. And then I talked to an editor and another woman at the publishing company, and they were just so excited about my book. And it was just an unbelievable moment. I broke down in tears after that.
Did they want you to change anything? Did you go through an editing process with an editor from their publishing company?
Yes, I had a developmental editor, and then we had copy editing and proofreading and all the regular editing things that you have to do. They go through the story and find places where you could improve, or you need more character development, or more details, less details. So they really just help you develop the story to a higher level.
How has being a published author, if at all, changed your life?
Not very much, really. I still live in the same house with the same husband and the same kids. And
the same animals.
It's just kind of, it's strange to have sold so many books in the online world, and you're still kind of anonymous in real life.
I know you have pets, cats and a dog, right?
Yes.
Yes. Because the animals in your book are so well-developed and smart that I just knew you had to be a pet mother as well. The cover art for this book is just beautiful, and it includes a lot of little graphic depictions of things in the story. How did the cover design come together?
Well, when I won the contest, they sent me a form to fill out that asked all kinds of questions about how I pictured the cover and what kind of elements I liked, and they wanted examples and pictures. And so I sent in the questionnaire, and they chose an artist, and he did some mock-up covers, and they sent me two to choose from, and this is the one that I ended up with.
You know, even the font seems to evoke the era as well. What advice would you give to any aspiring fiction writers who might be listening right now?
You have to read a lot. You have to write a lot and just keep trying and get into a writer's group where people can help you develop your talents and just keep trying and keep writing, because after a while you get better and better. You can't just sit down and expect to play a symphony at the piano the first time you sit down at the piano. You have to practice. And that's how writing is too.
Is there a group near where you live that you work with, a group of writers?
Yes, we have a group of writers that do NaNoWriMo every year, and we get together twice a month. And a lot of times we just talk, but some of the time we critique each other's stories, and it's a lot of fun.
What do you do when you're not writing?
I do a lot of regular mom stuff, cooking and cleaning. And
that's important. Yeah, that is a huge job. How many kids do you have?
I have four. Two are basically grown, but I have two teenage boys at home, so they require some attention.
They do. Yes, wow. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your coming out here to talk with us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That was author Carrie Ann Noble, who lives near Montoursville in the mountains of Pennsylvania. Her award-winning debut novel is The Mermaid Sister, published by Amazon. To hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.